Stay tuned for Nightline Africa, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Frances Alonso reporting. London Mayor Boris Johnson said Sunday he would back Britain's exit from the European Union in a June 23rd referendum, ending intense speculation over the position of one of British politics' most influential figures. Speaking to a crowd of reporters on the steps of his London home, Johnson said Prime Minister David Cameron had not achieved fundamental reform of the European Union. Meanwhile, Cameron's push to remain in the 28-member bloc comes after EU members agreed on a package of concessions to Britain, which the Prime Minister called special status.
The choice is in your hands, but my recommendation is clear. I believe that Britain will be safer, stronger, and better off in a reformed European Union.
You can read more details on this story at voanews.com. U.S. Secretary of State John Kerry said Sunday a provisional agreement has been made with Russia for a ceasefire in Syria's five-year civil war. However, violence continued throughout the country with scores of people killed in two separate attacks. Early estimates indicate that a deadly double bombing in homes early Sunday killed up to 60 people before another series of attacks later in the day hit Sadia Zainab south of Damascus. Bolivia is holding a referendum Sunday to decide whether to amend the constitution to allow President Evo Morales to run for a fourth consecutive term in 2019. Voters were evenly split on the issue. However, a growing number of Bolivians are starting to doubt the integrity of the current president. This is VOA News. Voters in Niger are going to the polls Sunday as well to elect a new parliament and to decide whether the president will receive a second five-year term. Mahamadou Issoufou is running with a promise to crush Islamist militants and develop one of the poorest countries in the world. Major developments, meanwhile, in the U.S. presidential contest. It was a big day in the race for the White House with Republican presidential candidate Donald Trump winning in South Carolina and Democrat Hillary Clinton coming out on top in Nevada. Here's VOA's national correspondent, Jim Malone.
The Clinton victory in Nevada is very important for her campaign. Bernie Sanders was closing in. They were able to stop his momentum. And so now she sets up for a strong performance in South Carolina in a week's time. The Republican side, Trump, a clear winner in South Carolina. That's a big step toward the Republican nomination. But a very tight battle between Ted Cruz and Marco Rubio for second in South Carolina. But both of them look as though they will go on in the race.
For Republican candidate, meanwhile, Jeb Bush, the race is over. He suspended his campaign after getting votes only in the single digits. Republicans Ben Carson and John Kasich, each of whom got less than 8% of the votes, have indicated that their campaigns will continue. 2 days of violent protests in northeastern India have turned deadly and plunged the capital of New Delhi into a water supply crisis. Haryana State has been the scene of a week-old demonstration by members of the Rural Agricultural Jat caste, and they are demanding federal and state benefits. However, the protests turned violent Friday, with demonstrators setting fire to homes and railway stations and damaging equipment that transports water from a canal in Haryana to New Delhi. At least five people were killed in a powerful cyclone that struck the South Pacific island nation of Fiji Saturday, and authorities have deployed storm teams and cleanup crews throughout the island chain to assess the damage from the cyclone. It was a Category 5 storm with winds up to 300 kilometers per hour and higher gusts, making it the strongest tropical cyclone to make landfall in Fiji. Egypt's prosecutor sent a police officer on trial for murder, according to the state news agency MENA Sunday, after he confessed to shooting dead a driver in the latest incident of alleged police brutality that has stirred public anger. Slow handling of the alleged abuses by police has prompted rare criticism of Egyptian authorities. I'm Frances Alonso.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Nightline Africa. We are coming to you live from the English service of the Voice of America. Thanks for joining us. I'm Peter Clote in Washington.
So the Electoral Commission was engaged in announcing some fictitious results, and that's what we wanted to expose. When the police invaded our party headquarters,
Uganda's main opposition leader, Kizza Besigye, calls for an independent investigation into the results of the elections.
L'heure n'est pas aux invectives.
He said it was not time for invective, but time for peace and love. He called on all Central Africans to commit to living in harmony with each other in the interests of the nation.
The Central African Republic elects former Prime Minister Faustin Archange Touadéra as president.
In terms of recognizing the role of women in the governance system, he is going to continue appointing women to positions of influence in government.
And Zambian President Edgar Lungu promises to nominate a female vice presidential running mate ahead of the August 11 elections. Those stories and more coming up on Nightline Africa. Uganda's main opposition leader of the Forum for Democratic Change, or FDC, has called for an independent audit of the general election. Dr. Kizza Besigye, who says he still remains in an illegal detention in his home, also says the results announced by the Electoral Commission were not credible. In an exclusive interview with VOA, Besigye told me the government is using state institutions like the police and the army to commit violence and act improperly, placing him under house arrest with no legal basis.
What prompted our arrest on the day of announcing the election results, the first day after the elections, was because we were preparing to address the media on the gross discrepancies between what the Electoral Commission was announcing and what presiding officers at this polling station had announced to be the results evidenced at those stations. So the Electoral Commission was engaged in announcing some fictitious results, and that's what we wanted to expose. When the police invaded our party headquarters, arrested us violently and took over our headquarters and removed the documents that we had in the headquarters. This was the culmination of many abuses that had taken place during the election itself.
The police came up with a statement saying that you attacked a police station that they are using for their operations to ensure peace and the stability of Uganda is not undermined, and that you undermine it, which is against the law, and that is why they arrested you.
Well, you see, if I was doing anything outside the law, then not only should they arrest me, they should arraign me in court and charge me with recognizable offenses. There is absolutely nothing that we are doing in our headquarters that violated the law. They took over the headquarters. If they found there anything illegal, they would have presented it to anybody to justify their cause. The matter at hand is that this is simply an overthrow of the will of the people of Uganda by the armed forces of Uganda, the Uganda police and the Ugandan military. It has nothing to do with anybody committing any kind of recognizable offense. And that's why we have rejected the outcome of this election and called for an independent audit to establish the grotesque, you know, what we consider to be a grotesque kind of fraud that took place in this election.
Dr. Beseje, the European Union and some other poll observer groups have said the elections were not fair. The U.S. Issued a statement saying Ugandans deserve better. Personally, what are your views about the conclusion that preliminary reports that they presented to Ugandans?
It didn't even need a comprehensive mission like we had, like they had in the EU or the Commonwealth or the African Union to make a report on this election. Any casual observer would have easily understood that this is not an election that would meet the most minimum standards established by the international community or by even our regional standards. You cannot, publish things and stop anybody whom you have given documents to the contrary and stop them from showing you that they're a contradiction and put me under house arrest and then put me in police cells, put me, detain me at home and blockade my house illegally. There is no basis, no legal basis of turning my home into prison. I am still a candidate, even if they assumed that what they published was all right. I have the right to contest it and to assemble evidence and take it to court within 10 days, all of which I cannot do because I'm a prisoner. This is simply a patently fraud election.
What would be your message to your supporters, FDC supporters and Ugandans who voted for you?
I'd like them to remain strong, to remain focused on regaining our rights and our control of our country, and to firmly oppose any attempt at, turning us into subjects in our own country. And we are challenging what is going on. And I'm confident that if we do not cooperate with the regime that takes over power in this way, the regime will not survive.
Dr. Chisa Beseje is the leader of Uganda's main opposition party, the Forum for Democratic Change, FDC. He spoke with me from the capital, Kampala. Meanwhile, press freedom advocates in Uganda criticized intimidation of the press during the campaign as well as the government shutdown of social media. The government said it was to prevent lies, confusion and possible public disorder. It said many were using the social media to continue campaigning, a violation of electoral law. Kerry Patterson is the Africa Research Associate of the Committee to Protect Journalists. VOA's William Eagle spoke to her about the decision to clamp down on Facebook, Twitter, and other social media outlets.
The disabling of social media on voting day really just sort of appears like the latest in a string of sort of crackdowns and in an increasingly hostile environment towards the media throughout this entire election cycle. We've seen arrests, we've seen threats, we've seen intimidations, we've seen shutdowns. And so, I think one of the things that we can sort of see is that this obviously serves to constrict, the space for public debate and the space for public discourse, in and around election on the day that people are voting, but also impedes the ability to share information that people might need. You know, if someone wants to know that there's a change in traffic or there's a problem at a polling station or that sort of information, the government has no place impeding the free flow of information between the people. And it's pretty clear that that's sort of what was happening here.
Kerry, around the world, social media has been used up through Election Day and past Election Day without being prohibited. Is there any evidence anywhere in the world or anywhere in Africa that you know of where social media either was used to create chaos, to cause violence, or to throw elections, or to cheat in some way?
I don't know that there are examples of that I can sort of think of offhand. To sort of flip your question on its head a little, I think there are certainly examples of other governments cracking down on the use of social media and cracking down on sort of platforms for communication in and around elections or around discussions of elections in order to impede that discourse from happening. In January of last year, we saw a similar sort of shutdown happen in the Democratic Republic of Congo when there was a sort of rally of opposition to the current government and the possibility that he might extend his stay in office. In May, when the protests started really heating up, or end of April, that the protests in Burundi started really heating up, and into what eventually we have come to see as quite a severe crisis. But in the election that they had this summer, the government similarly had shutdowns of WhatsApp and decreasing access to social media. And so that sort of practice to try and prevent critical voices from being heard, information from being shared, and sort of meaningful communication amongst civilians and citizens is not uncommon, particularly in this part of Africa, unfortunately.
What type of press restrictions were issued by the government for these elections, and were they reasonable, or were they made up at the last minute, or maybe not clearly codified and understood?
I'd broaden out from the use of the word restriction, which is to say that a lot of these things aren't sort of happening under the letter of the law or are practices intended to intimidate or chill the discourse. We've seen, in addition to shutdowns, we've seen reporters get assaulted. We've seen reporters complain of harassment, of intimidation by authorities and police officers and Ugandan government officials. We've documented a number of tactics that were intended specifically to stifle media freedom, from arbitrary station closures to, sort of direct threats at journalists who are seen to be critical of the ruling party or of Museveni himself. And to speak quite candidly, Museveni is quite well practiced at organizing media crackdowns around election time. It was designed to limit the scrutiny of the electoral process. It's designed to limit the scrutiny of the tallying of votes. And it's a pattern of behavior that we've witnessed in previous elections in 2006 and 2011.
From the point of view of your group, the Committee to Protect Journalists, were these elections based on the intimidation of the media? Were they free and fair?
I can't speak to the election process as a whole. What I can say is that the EU observers have issued statements, saying that the intimidation of voters and the blocking of social media and preventing people from communicating, impedes, sort of free and fair access to what's going on. I think that that's a pretty good indicator that there's a long way to go before we can call these totally free and fair. They certainly were not free and fair to the media. And I don't know how free and fair you can call an election when the party in power is essentially put in a position where they are limiting the public's ability to communicate information, to engage with one another, or to speak critically. When you've gone out of your way to silence those voices and prevent those people from being heard, I'm not sure how meaningfully free and fair we can call an election. My guess is that, in the past, what we've seen, barring any sort of widespread protests following the sort of final tallying of votes or announcement of sort of final numbers, is that the government in Uganda tends to sort of gradually ease up once Museveni seems to feel that its sort of reign is secure. But unfortunately, that's not an indication that an election was necessarily free, fair, or functional. That's an indication that somebody feels comfortable in a seat of power.
Kerry Patterson is the Africa Research Associate of the Committee to Protect Journalists. She spoke with VOA's William Eagle. In the Central African Republic, former Prime Minister Faustin Archange Touadéra has been declared the winner of the February 14 presidential election. According to provisional results of the poll, Touadéra won with nearly two-thirds of the vote cast. For VOA, Nick Long has more from the capital, Bangui.
Speaking to reporters Saturday, the president of the National Election Authority, Marie-Madeleine Nkoet, read out results of the presidential poll.
Total pour Dologele.
She said Georges Anissé Doleguele, who came in first in the first round, obtained just over 413,000 votes in the runoff, or 37.3%, while Faustin Archange Touadéra came first with 695,000 votes, or 62.7%. Out of 1.95 million registered voters, 1.15 million cast ballots, about 59%. Results of the first round of the parliamentary poll were not announced Saturday, but are expected soon. Touadéra's campaign director, Samplice Seranji, made a short statement.
L'heure
n'est pas aux invectives.
He said it was not time for invective, but time for peace and love. He called on all Central Africans to commit to living in harmony with each other in the interests of the nation. It is hoped these elections will close a particularly turbulent chapter in the Central African Republic's history. In the conflicts of the past 4 years, the CAR government, which always had difficulty exercising authority outside the capital, virtually ceased to exist. Security in the country is still largely provided by some 13,000 international peacekeepers, and the administration depends on subsidies from donors. The new president has pledged to rebuild the state, working closely with the international community. Observers said Touadera's election victory stemmed from the reputation he gained as prime minister between 2008 and 2013, when government worker salaries were paid regularly. Although only some 24,000 Central Africans are on the government's payroll, many of them help provide for dozens of people besides their immediate family. Touadera's supporters, including many of the city's taxi drivers, celebrated his victory noisily, and celebrations look set to continue into the night. Nick Long for VOA News, Bangui.
Zambia's president Edgar Lungu says he will nominate a female vice presidential running mate for his re-election bid for the governing Patriotic Front Party ahead of the August 11 general election. Speaking to women group at a breakfast meeting in the capital, Lusaka, Mr. Lungu encouraged women participation in the country's governance, including in the upcoming general election. Father Frank Bwalya, deputy spokesman for the ruling party, says he hopes the president's decision could stop the lobbying for the position in the party.
What the president said was that taking from what President Michael Chilufya-Sata did in terms of recognizing the role of women in the governance system, he is going to continue appointing women positions of influence in government. Then he went on to say that as a result of that, is going to nominate a woman as his running mate. Then he said, if you are a man and you are thinking that you are going to be my running mate, you will not be, because my running mate is going to be a woman. And he was speaking to a breakfast meeting mainly attended by women, because it was meant to say something about encouraging women, empowering them to participate in the forthcoming election.
Father Bwalya, does this quieting some of the jostling within the party and some of the lobbying within the party?
I want to believe that the men who may have been thinking they would be picked, the message is very clear to them. I want to believe, therefore, that if there were some people who are jostling to be adopted, those that were lobbying, if they are men, they must know that they are out of the race.
With this signal, what does that mean for the ruling party in the run-up to the election?
Our president has earned the nickname of Mr. Walk the Talk. So he doesn't preach one thing on one hand and then do the other on the other. He doesn't do that. What he says is what he does. What he preaches is what he does. So since he preaches gender equality, it is very clear that driven by that kind of a consideration, he thinks the right thing for us to do as PF is to adopt a woman as running mate. In more or less the same way he has picked a woman as vice president. What this means is that after 11th August 2016, we are going to have again a woman as vice president, because automatically the running mate is going to become the vice president.
Father Bwalya, talking about promises that President Edgar Lungu has made previously, opposition supporters are saying, some of them have accused him of inciting violence ahead of the election. What do you say to such criticism?
The opposition have nothing credible to use against PF and against our president. So much that this time they are stranded. And even when the president makes a mistake, by clearly slip of the tongue, they will still take it as this is what the president has said. They will go to town accusing the president of this act, trying to extend it so as to decampaign the president.
The truth of the matter is that President Edgar Chagwalungu, speaking at home as well as abroad, he has never said anything that would be understood, even by remotely, of encouraging or inciting violence. Nothing at all. And there is nothing in his life, his entire life, that would point to a person who sponsors violence. Nothing. The opposition are stranded. They have no issues to talk about. They can't talk about PF having failed to deliver development because we have turned Zambia literally into a construction site. If in Zambia today you threw a stone, chances that it will land on a PF project are 90%.
Talking about all these promises that the PF has made, Hakainde Hichilema has said that the government has failed to provide jobs for the youth, and that it obviously states that the President Edgar Lungu has yet to keep the promises of creating jobs for the youth. And he says that youth unemployment is skyrocketing, and that is a moral issue that Zambians should reject the president when he comes for re-election. What do you say to that?
President Hakainde Hichilema has failed to give even one way of creating employment in Zambia. He has failed. For him, when he says President Lungu and the PF have failed to create jobs, what he actually means is that we have not been able to create jobs for everyone, and that is impossible.
Father Frank Bwalya is the deputy spokesman for Zambia's ruling Patriotic Front, or PF party. He spoke with me from the capital, Lusaka. In Kenya, interest rates on business loans can go as high as 26%. But an American quote techpreneur has now developed an app through which Kenyans can get loans at reduced rates via their mobile phones and Facebook. For VOA, Lenny Ruvaga reports from Nairobi.
Samuel Kinuthia, a chef in Nairobi, begins his workday by preparing ingredients for the day's special. He has been a chef for the last 18 years and started his own catering business last year to supplement his regular income. Kinuthia got a loan to start his business through Branch, a microlender that provides financial services including loans to Kenya residents. He says Branch has been a boon for his business.
A catering bit is quite expensive, and I've been trying to acquire a few items here and there, but Branch has been with me all along the way. And it's also less of a hassle because at 8 to 9% interest on a 42-day loan is quite easy to maintain and quite friendly. And then the repayment plan, you can pay in small amounts even before the scheduled payment date.
Introduced in 2015 by Matt Flannery, Branch is a microfinance institution that has been billed as a bank in your pocket. The app can be accessed on Google Play Store and on Facebook. For a six-month repayment period, clients can apply for loans from as little as $10 to a maximum of $500, and the interest rates are as low as 5% in a country where banks charge as much as 26%. There are three other major companies targeting the microloan market: Mshwari, Mkoopcash, and KCB M-Pesa, all of them linked to large commercial banks.
We don't necessarily see ourselves as directly competing with them. We don't think this is a winner-takes-all market. We're very excited to be working alongside them, and I think we're all working towards the same kind of goal here.
And for Samuel Kinuthia, that goal is using advancements in technology to make it easier to expand his business. Lenny Ruvaga for VOA News, Nairobi, Kenya.
This is the Voice of America, and you're listening to Nightline Africa. I'm your host, Peter Clotte, in Washington, coming up in the second half of Nightline Africa Sports with Douglas Mpuga and music from our African collection. And that will be followed by a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Undersecretary General for Political Affairs. It's now time for Nightline Africa Sports, and for that, let's join Douglas Mpuga. Good evening, Douglas.
Hi, Peter. And good evening, sports fans. Welcome to Nightline Africa Sports. In African football, TP Mazembe of the Democratic Republic of Congo clinched the third African Super Cup when they defeated Tunisia's Etoile du Sahel 2-1 in Lubumbashi on Saturday. African champions Mazembe also won the prestigious annual fixture between the winners of the Champions League and the Confederation Cup in 2010 and 2011. Etoile, who won the 2015 Confederation Cup, have also won the competition twice. Ghanaian striker Daniel Ni-Adjei scored twice to set up Mazembe's win. He opened the scoring for Mazembe after 20 minutes when he powered his header off the Jean Kasasula cross from the left beyond goalkeeper Ayamen Matholoi. 27-year-old Ajay doubled his tally in the 45th minute when he acrobatically finished off a lovely attack after he was set up by striker partner Jonathan Bolingi. The Tunisian Red Devils pulled the goal back in first half stoppage time, but through Mohamed Meskine, who stabbed home from inside the box after a goal mouth scramble. Mazembe held on to record another international triumph in front of their jubilant home fans. Still in football, Kenya have replaced Bobby Williamson as coach of the national team with former youth coach Stanley Okumbi for the next round of Africa Cup of Nations qualifiers. The newly elected Football Kenya Federation president Nick Mwenda said Okumbi, who coached Kenyan Premiership side Mathare United last season, will take interim charge at the Harambee Stars when they play Guinea-Bissau next month. Williamson has been the Kenyan national coach since August 2014. He was believed to be owed up to $30,000 in salary arrears by the former Football Kenya Federation. Mwenda said on the Federation's website that his decision to overhaul the coaching setup followed a meeting with Williamson on Monday, adding that the appointment of Okumbi is geared towards building a local capacity. Former international Musa Otieno, who was Williamson's assistant, has been retained. Under Williamson, Kenya drew 1-1 away to Congo and lost 2-1 at home to Zambia in their first two 2017 Nations Cup matches. In athletics, Kenya's Cosmos Kiplimo Lagat regained the Zurich Marathon de Saville title he won on his marathon debut in 2014, improving his on-course record at the IAAF Bronze Label Road Race to 2 hours, 8 minutes and 14 seconds in the Spanish city on Sunday. Kiplimo Lagat took 19 seconds off his on-course record set 2 years ago. In 2014, he was signed up as a pacemaker before heading off on his own for a surprise win, but this time he was accorded the number one bib. In almost ideal weather for fast times at about 12 degrees Celsius and a very slight breeze, right from the start, it became clear that Kiplimo Lagat's 2014 course record of 2 hours, 8 minutes and 33 seconds was under threat. Paced by three pace setters led by Uganda's Thomas Ayeko and Kenya's Emmanuel Bett, the opening 10 kilometers was covered in 29 minutes and 57 seconds. A group of nine went through the halfway point in 1 hour, 3 minutes and 36 seconds, suggesting that the course record was on the cards. Over the next 9 kilometers, the pace of the leaders still stayed on course for a time close to 2 hours, although one by one, the group at the front started to disintegrate. Just before 34 kilometers, Kiplimo Lagat decided to shake off his rivals and quickly established a big lead never to be headed. Behind him, Spain's experienced international, Charles Castillejo, came through strongly over the final 7 kilometers to finish second in 2 hours, 11 minutes and 29 seconds to claim the Spanish national title and guarantee a place on Spain's Rio 2016 Olympic Games team. A group of African athletes set the early pace in the women's race as the Kenyan trio of Miriam Wangari, Raul Jeptoi, and Eunice Jepto, plus Ethiopia's Roman Mengisu, went through the first 10 kilometers in 35.30, which put them on schedule for sub 2.30 final time. The women's race was soon reduced to a three-way fight between Ethiopia's Abebeche Segei Bekele, Kenya's Mercy Jelimo, and Philomena Costa. Both Bekele and Jelimo began to falter around 28 kilometers into the race, leaving Costa on her own with just male club runners for company. Costa's finishing time of 2 hours 28 minutes was second fastest women's time in Seville and more than 3 minutes faster than she had ever run before. Bekele came in a distant second, but still in the personal best time of 2 hours 33 minutes and 49 seconds, while Jelimo was third in 2 hours 34.52. Organizers estimated that around 11,500 runners were on the streets of the city, which famously hosted the 1999 IAAF World Championships. And finally, in tennis, Rafael Nadal failed to reach his 100th ATP final after losing in three sets to unseeded Uruguayan Pablo Chavez in the Rio Open semifinals. The 14-time Grand Slam champion and top seed won a first-set tiebreak and saved two set points in the second, but was beaten 6-7, 7-6, 6-4. World number 45 Chavez will meet the unseeded Guido Pella in the final. The consecutive semifinal defeats for Nadal continue a disappointing season, which began with the first round loss to Fernando Verdasco in the Australian Open. And that's it for this edition of Nightline Africa Sports. Now back to you, Peter.
Thanks a lot, Douglas. It's always a pleasure to hear from you. We'll link up with you again next Sunday for another look at African sports. Nightline Africa Sports. It's Sunday on Nightline Africa, and this is the time we get to relax and reflect. A flashback with music from the continent.
The way she dance, the way she move, just makes me wanna take her home. The way she carry that bag, they make me want to carry this girl in the boat. And I love her, and I like her, and I wanna take her home. So we go dance, and we go jolly, and we go party like 99. Oh, she make me not shun the knee. Me five.
Ashona Baba Ariyo Anomilowo Mrs. J. Balogun Moriyo Anomilowo Mr. Wellington Oh Akiyo Anomilowo
Arema Arema They must be mad. Cause if I die today, nobody gon' die with me.
I know my jam.
If I go broke today, I won't ever hear my phone ring.
I know my jam.
I don't send nobody, I'ma keep doing my thing. Yeah. And if you're feeling me now, then let me hear you sing. My child remain, my child remain, my child remain. New way all out. Then they ask me, how much money you they carry? You don't hold now, when you go marry? You sure say, now you wasting chassis.
I used to be rap, baby,
sick of face. Is everything cool with TMZ? Everything cool with you and Weezy?
Yeah.
I did walk and they talk, but I won't stop. Cause I got too much money left for me. Now Baba God says so. Mama Ramoto. Baba Tiffy, me see for my child, really. Surely movie, my show re general, hello, general,
let's go.
Cause if I die today, nobody gon' die with me.
I know my channel.
If I go broke today, I won't ever hear my phone ring.
I know my channel.
I don't send nobody, I'ma keep doing my thing. And if you're feeling me now, then let me hear you sing.
Girl. My child, really, my child, really. My child,
really, new mayor, law.
My child, really, my child, really, my child, really,
oh, darling, you let the world shine. See the comment for your mind now. You just say you get talent. Shit, I only you where they go give endorsement. I deflect and effects, but I no send them, no send them away. Enemies can't stop me, no way. In the club, by the pop, by the throw away.
People just love to they hit me. I seen the comments on Linda Ikeji. I know some people love to they underrate me. It's no mistaking, I'm elevated. If they could kill Jesus and he was perfect, say what they want about me cause I'm worthless. So when they put you to the test, just do your best and let God do the rest. An enemy's stress, I'm a living witness, I'm the proof. Nothing is impossible and that's the truth. You can achieve if you plan to. If I can make it, man, you can too. They say my skin no fresh, it got to be bleached. This hair really no fine, I'm on that film tree. I don't need puff up, I'm getting too much cake. And I got a big head, I'm blessed with too much brain.
My
I am a bell.
Is
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 they complain, oh. I be now your papa give me the money, I dey spend, oh. Whether you like it or not, yeah. I will still know they like it, yeah. African music, then they miss it, yeah.
Leda. Fish no get feather, love we I get no get weather. Kaki no so leather, fish no get feather, the love we I get no get weather. Ah. Oh na 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 na.
I'm coming.
Nigga don't know you. This a song for all the lovers out there. Nigga, baby, picture me and you. But I know the past, so I can't live a moment without you. Now one day I do. It can is not easy, but I know it's impossible for me to fly, no. Only you. Oh yeah. Take bullets for you, me, I know they afraid you.
Baby, what? Tell me what?
Talk to the news and all over the
radio.
Oh, oh, oh. Ah,
tell
me what. Ah, tell only one, yo. Ah, say me
too, oh,
you. A beautiful girl like you, need man like me. I'm always gonna make you feel alright, man like me. A beautiful girl like you, need man like me. I'm always gonna make you feel alright. Like me, because you know, don't let that fish not get better. The love we I get, no get weather. So, you know, don't let that fish not get better. The love we I get, no get weather.
And that was our Sunday music spot. Hope you enjoyed the music from Nightline Africa. Here are the English service of the Voice of America. Now let's take a closer look at Africa, the problems, the prospect in time of conflict, in time of peace. Here's one man's point of view with Dr. James Jonah, former UN Under-Secretary General for Political Affairs. Good evening, Dr. Jonah.
Good evening, Africa. The death of Dr. Boutros Ghali of Egypt and the 6th Secretary General of the United Nations represented a grave loss for Africa. He was an intellectual giant and was a credit to Africa during his time at the United Nations. It is therefore commendable that the Egyptian government staged a state funeral last week for him. Dr. Boutros Ghali embodied all the characteristics of a major secretary general. He has a brilliant mind, he has fierce independence, and was a man of absolute integrity. But he encountered problems from two sides. Many Africans find it difficult to accept that he was an African, and they fell into the trap of the colonial powers that made a demarcation in Africa between Africa north of the Sahara and Africa south of the Sahara. But this is not something which any intelligent African should follow. He was the first African Secretary General of the United Nations. In fact, he was put up by the then OAU, Organization of African Unity. And when he came to the UN, he annoyed some of the members of the Security Council when he criticized them for what he called tackling the rich man's war in Bosnia and neglecting the poor man's war in Somalia. He never ceased to promote African interests at the United Nations. Despite resistance from some major powers, he was able to get the UN involved in Somalia, in Liberia, in Angola, in Mozambique, and also, among others, in South Africa. And for those who may doubt his commitment to Africa, one should look at the record, a record in which, during his time in the Secretariat, most of the key positions were occupied by Africans. In fact, of the three key portfolios, two of them were occupied by Africans. Compare that after Dr. Boutros Ghali left the United Nations. He was also determined that Africa should stand up for its rights. This may explain why, in the end, he became the only Secretary General who was not able to be given a second term. We know of his problems with the United States, the country which indeed vetoed him several times in the Security Council. But they could not have succeeded in trying to deny him the second term without some elements of betrayal and blind ambition. Boutros Ghali showed Africans how to stand up and be counted. Dr. Boutros Ghali tried desperately to encourage African diplomats to pay attention to the interest of Africa. And maybe his efforts may account for his abandonment by a number of African countries at the crucial moment when he was under attack. But as he said in his book, after he left the UN unvanquished, he held his head high and believed that his way, even though some might say he did not have the temperament of a Secretary General, was the only way for Africa to be part of the international community. Thank you.
That was Waman's Point of View, a commentary by Dr. James Jonah, former UN Under Secretary General for Political Affairs. Nightline Africa comes to you from the English service of the Voice of America. Hope you enjoy the program tonight. As you know by now, we are on air on Saturdays and Sundays at 16 and 18 hours UTC. And from the Nightline Africa team, managing editor Shaka Sally, reporter Douglas Mpuga, producer Odette Frazier, and our engineer for today, Zainab Abdelrahman, we say thanks for joining us. And as the elders say, two bulls fighting must disengage their heads before one is defeated. I'm your host, Peter Clotter, in Washington. Good evening, Africa.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
Officials from the U.S. government's Millennium Challenge Corporation, the MCC, visited Côte d'Ivoire this month to congratulate the government on its eligibility to develop an MCC Compact program. In December 2015, the MCC Board of Directors selected Côte d'Ivoire as compact eligible, following several years of steady improvement by the government of Côte d'Ivoire on the MCC scorecard of policy indicators, and a strong year-long partnership with MCC in developing an MCC threshold program for which Côte d'Ivoire became eligible in December 2014. Compacts are large, five-year investments that address a country's greatest constraints to economic growth. And threshold programs are smaller-scale investments designed for countries that don't yet qualify for a compact. The work done by Côte d'Ivoire on threshold program development will provide a solid foundation for an innovative compact program. On its most recent MCC scorecard, Côte d'Ivoire passed 13 out of 20 indicators, demonstrating remarkable improvement from passing only 5 indicators in 2013. Since its selection for eligibility for a threshold program, the government of Côte d'Ivoire has been a committed and collaborative partner. The government has remained highly engaged with indicator institutions, identifying reforms and providing data updates needed to improve its overall performance. U.S. Ambassador Terence McCulley said, "The MCC Compact is a strong symbol of the United States' partnership with Côte d'Ivoire as it moves toward its goal of becoming an emerging economy by 2020. In its selection decision, MCC's board also expressed its support for Côte d'Ivoire to explore potential regional investments with neighboring countries. MCC recognizes that growth is more dependent than ever on economic integration. Countries can grow faster, create more jobs, and attract more investment when they are part of dynamic regional markets. The potential for a regional investment is great, given the critical role Côte d'Ivoire plays in the West Africa region." Côte d'Ivoire's transition from developing a threshold program to developing a compact program is a testament to the country's continued commitment to strong policy improvement and political stability, as evidenced by its recent presidential elections.
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.